You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. Today is December 4th, 2017, and my name is Whitney Neggebauer. We have a guest on our show today, Jeanette Dorner from the Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group. But first, I would like to get you all caught up on some of the recent news going on in Whale Scout. Over the weekend, we did a Help and Out event at Whitney Bridge Park in Auburn with King County Parks, and it was very, very rainy. It seems like every time we do a Help and Out event in December, we get rained on. Not to say that other months of the year we don't get skunked as far as weather goes, but we were definitely bathing in our liquid sunshine last weekend. We're still waiting on a final tree count, but 300 trees are placed in that area right along the Green River. The property was actually a former pasture, and since it was pasture land, the King County has purchased the property, turned it into a park, and now that area is being restored. And the Green River is home to four species of Pacific salmon, including the big ones for killer whales, Chinook, Coho, and Chum. So it was a really important event. You can read more about how the day went and see photos of us drenched up at whalescout.org. If you're interested in more of that kind of fun, we have two more Helping Out events. One's January 27th along the, it's actually at the mouth of the Elwha River. This is going to be one of our most interesting projects. We're working with the Lower Elwha Kalalem Tribe and the Olympic Park to do a planting event right at the mouth of the newly formed sort of beach area. Since the dams were removed, there's been a huge amount of sediment that's come down through the river that was blocked for decades. And so we're going to kind of help nature along a little bit by planting some plants at the river mouth and help the estuary, which is home to lots of juvenile salmon and forage fish, all the way down the bottom of the food chain. After that, February 24th at Idlewood Park, something a little bit closer to home, right in Redmond, we are going to be working there. We did a Helping Out event last year, you may have gone to, so join us again with Lori Gogich. She is our one of our volunteers, and she's coordinated actually both of these events, and she is a forest steward at Idlewood Park. So she's a local expert. More information about both of these is up on our website, whalescout.org, and you can also find information on Facebook. Lastly, keep an eye out for our end of the year fundraising campaign. We try not to do too much fundraising and keep you all up to date with the news and ways to get involved with helping our whales, but it is obviously something that is necessary for us. And so we use an online fundraising platform, and you'll be seeing it towards the end of the year. So keep it in mind for your holiday shopping and your end of the year giving. And an update on our whales. We've actually had in the Puget Sound area, according to Orca Network, resident killer whales have been seen or heard every day in the inland waters since November 26th. So that's rather impressive. So all of you local Puget Sound whale watchers, be sure to follow us on Facebook and follow our mobile alerts by texting whales. Follow Whale Scout as one word to 40404 for the updates on where our naturalists are out watching whales. We also, I should say, did an event on the day after Thanksgiving on Black Friday, which REI has coined the campaign Opt Outside Day. Where we had naturalists scattered all the way around Puget Sound, helping folks out watch whales. Unfortunately, there weren't any whales seen that day, but I know a lot of great connections were made on the shorelines. And other interesting factoid here, there have been some bottlenose dolphins found in Puget Sound, and they've been spotted off and on for quite a while now, which is unusual. They're more of a warm water species. And Cascadia Research down in Olympia has been able to identify one of the dolphins as Miss, a dolphin commonly seen in California, whose group's movements have been moving further and further north in recent years. But why MIS is in Puget Sound is still a question that's yet to be answered and is a little bit concerning, as some of the other bottlenose dolphins who've shown up in Puget Sound in the past have died. So we'll have to see how MIS and these other bottlenose dolphins are going to fare in Puget Sound. Next, I'd like to introduce our guest, Jeanette Dorner, but I should say that our interview was recorded previously on November 17th. I had hoped to get this podcast up sooner, although we left to go out of town for Thanksgiving, and I thought, well, that'd be a perfect opportunity to get it done, but toddler got super sick, so that occupied my time, and now, as you can tell, I'm sick. So my apologies here. You will notice that's not 100% up to date. For example, just before Thanksgiving, an article came out about salmon predation by seals in Puget Sound and a huge impact that these seals are having in depleting and limiting recovery efforts for Chinook salmon. And had that article come out beforehand, I probably would have asked her about it, but perhaps in our next interview. Here's Jeanette Dorner. She is the former director of Salmon and Ecosystem Recovery for the Puget Sound Partnership and now the current executive director for the Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast. We are joined by Jeanette Dorner. And Jeanette, I think I first met you actually on the beach at Point Robinson, and I was out looking for whales. It was really early on in the Whale Scout days, and I think you were there with your kids, and you had already known about Whale Scout, and I was like blown away, and because nobody knew about Whale Scout, and so it was just really cool to meet you in that way, and see salmon people really interested in whales. Have you always been interested in whales and salmon?
Well, you know, it's funny that you remember that. I forgot that's the first time that we had met. You know, that was a really special day because that was the first time I got to take my kids to actually see orcas in real life. And we had been having breakfast at home that morning, and I got a text alert that the orcas were coming down. And I told the kids, I said, all right, we're going to jump in the car. We're going to take the ferry. We're going to go check this out, see if we see anything. And I had no idea if we were going to, but my son, who's 14, he's 14 now. He's fascinated by wildlife. So I had been looking for opportunities even more. You know, I've always loved the Puget Sound area and the wildlife and the ecosystem. You know, I grew up here and spent a lot of time out in the natural world growing up. Parents took me camping a lot, and so it's always been special to me. And it's actually just my love for the place that drew me to the work that I do to recover salmon, because I realized how integral salmon are as part of our ecosystem and our landscape and the health of our community. And then as I learned more about our resident orcas and the fact that they exclusively eat the salmon, that made me feel even more connected to them, because realizing that that the salmon were important in that way as well, and that these beautiful, iconic creatures that, you know, that day on the beach, I was blown away by how many people showed up on that beach just to watch the whales swim by, and we're so excited to see them. And so you can see that when you see that, you see how much people care about this place and these beautiful creatures. And it's inspiring, because then you know that people really do want to take care of this place, and the work that we do makes a difference.
So fast forward to now, can you explain what your role is with Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group?
Yeah, so I started with this group in January, and I'm the executive director, and we are part of a network of 14 nonprofits across the state of Washington that all have the same mission, but just different geographic areas that we focus on. And our mission basically is to work with people in the community to do projects and to teach people about salmon recovery. So we look for opportunities to do restoration projects in places that will make a difference for the fish. And we also try to teach folks wherever we're going about salmon and how we can take care of them and what they can do to help us take care of the salmon and to make sure that they're salmon for future generations.
So do you work... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so my position, you know, as an executive director, it's like any nonprofit, all the things that come with an executive director of a nonprofit. We are pretty small right now. Our particular organization, it's just me and one other part-time person. So I kind of have multiple hats that I wear to make sure that we're doing good things with the group. So I go out and meet with folks in the community, look for opportunities to do good projects, apply for grants to do good projects, help implement projects, help organize outreach opportunities, volunteer opportunities for tree plantings. So kind of the whole gamut right now. I'm hopeful that as I continue to work with folks in the community and apply for grants, that we will be able to increase our resource base where we can get to the point where I can have a few other team members that can help me do this work in our region, because it's been pretty obvious to me this year that there is plenty to do, and we just need more time to be able to do all the things that are needed to be done to take care of the fish.
And so do you work with property owners, work on private land or public?
Yeah, so we do. We can do both. We were originally created with the idea that it would be important to help private property owners who might want to do the right thing on their property. They might own a stream or be on a shoreline, but don't know themselves, like how, you know, what the fish need or how they could get help to restore habitat on their property or just maintain the habitat. So we were created to do that outreach with private landowners. But we've also found that sometimes there are, you know, public landowners, jurisdictions who might not have capacity internally to do projects like this and really welcome that support and that partnership. Really, all of this work is about partnerships with people in the community. And the more partners you have, the stronger the project is. So we will work with other nonprofits, with jurisdictions, with private landowners, wherever there's an opportunity for us to help. And that makes a difference for the fish.
And tell us a little bit about the status of Chinook salmon in Puget Sound.
Well, Chinook were listed under the Endangered Species Act back in 1999 as threatened, which is one step below endangered. And so since that time, they have been on the ESA list as threatened. There has been a lot of work that's happened since that time to put together a recovery plan, a federally approved recovery plan that was completed back in 2007 for the Chinook salmon. And then folks have been working together to implement that plan since that time. And there is still a lot to do to implement that plan.
And, you know, of course, us whale folks are really interested in the Chinook salmon because they're a primary food source for our southern resident killer whales, along with coho and chum, especially during the fall months. Is there a leading cause or cure for salmon recovery in Puget Sound? Like, is there some major things that we should be looking at?
Yeah, you know, the thing that's interesting about salmon recovery is that many people want to sort of point to one single thing or one single action, because it's always easy to simplify. But there are many things that are affecting the fish. But one thing that we do know is that habitat is a pretty critical component of the success of the fish. And if you think of it at a very basic level, if you don't have a shelter, if you don't have food to eat, if you don't have a place to hide from predators, your likelihood of survival is going to be a lot less. And it's the same thing for the salmon. So we have dramatically altered this landscape in the last 150, 200 years. And in doing that, we have changed our rivers and streams and our shorelines in such a way that there are less good places for the fish to live. And that has been one of the biggest factors for the reason that we see the decline of salmon populations in Puget Sound and in other regions. Now, there certainly is harvest that has affected the fish in the past. I would say that for folks that really want to focus on harvest, the problem with that right now is that there's been a massive amount of attention on harvest, actually. Most folks in the public don't hear about it because it's really a negotiation between the federal agency that's accountable for the endangered species listing, which is the National Marine Fisheries Service, and then the two groups of co-managers of the fisheries in Washington State, which is the state, and then all of the treaty tribes. And they go through a pretty massive amount of work every year to look at all the different populations of salmon that are predicted to return, to do modeling, to look at how many are predicted to return, to look at which populations are still healthy, because not all of them are listed under the Endangered Species Act, fortunately, and which ones are not, and which are coming from hatcheries, and so it's fine to fish on those because they're not the wild populations we're trying to save. And so there's a lot of different factors, but the basic thing to know is that the fishing pressure on listed species, the ones that are in trouble, has been reduced dramatically. So when you see people are fishing on hatchery fish or healthy populations that the managers have looked at and said, you know, there's a certain number of fish it's safe for us to take without hurting the population of the fish. So really, instead of pointing a finger at something that there's only a few people that actually have the decision making over, doing the things that we do have control over, and the biggest thing that the large number of people in the public can make a difference in and have control over is habitat. And so that's what our group is focused on, is helping people to restore habitat, because ultimately, if there's no places for the fish to live, then they're not going to recover.
And speaking to that catch issue, you know, there are people who in the whale world are calling for reduction or a complete elimination of the fisheries for a few years and see what happens. I always kind of wonder, like, if we do this temporarily, is it going to happen again? Are we going to do it for a longer time down the road? And if we lose that connection to the fish as a food source, do you see that as a negative impact to potentially restoring these fish?
Yeah, you know, the thing about that makes it unusual, this particular endangered species, is that salmon aren't just important intrinsically as a species. This is part of the ecosystem. They're important to us because we like to eat them also. And they are also, for tribes, they are an essential part of their culture and their history and their way of life. And so losing the opportunity to catch fish is actually it significantly impacts their ability to maintain their culture and who they are as a people. So it becomes a very big deal to say we're just going to stop fishing completely. So that's where understanding that it is not just this one-size-fits-all approach, that it is okay to fish on, like, returning hatchery populations. Like, those are not contributing to the recovery of the wild fish, which is what we're working on in terms of, you know, if you fish on those hatchery fish, it doesn't cause problems for the wild fish. And in fact, it can help. So to just completely shut down fisheries isn't necessarily the smartest solution. And you do lose part of that connection to the fish, as you're saying. But, you know, I think it becomes an easy sort of scapegoat, too, honestly, because if you can point the finger at somebody else and say, well, they just need to stop fishing, but you're not doing anything about the things you can make a difference in, then, you know, there are some scientists that have done an analysis that said we could just completely shut down all fisheries and it would not make a difference in terms of, at this point. In the past, it did. In the past, there was overfishing, and that has been managed now. And so at this point, if we shut down what's remaining of the fisheries that are fishing on the hatchery populations and the healthy populations, then are we going to wait 5 years to see if that makes a difference before we decide to do anything about habitat? Or is it more prudent to just be working like crazy on restoring habitat? It seems like we shouldn't use that as an excuse to ignore the significant problem we have with habitat.
What are some ways that you would encourage those who live in this area, who love whales, who love salmon, and want to restore habitat? Where would you point them?
So I would say that they should be looking to organizations like ourselves to sign up to volunteer. We have tree planting projects where people can come out. We have projects where we remove invasives. There's also, you know, in the areas that we work, King County and part of Kitsap County is the area that my group is focused on. There are a lot of different organizations that are doing work to restore salmon habitat. And so, you know, you don't just have to volunteer with our group. So there's lots of, you know, but if people are listening to this podcast and they want to figure out where they could go to, they can contact us and we can get them on our volunteer list and we can help them know about other organizations that do the same kind of work so that they have multiple places they can look to for volunteer opportunities, especially if they actually own property on a river or a stream or a shoreline. Then they have an even greater opportunity to contribute, because if they can invite someone who knows about salmon habitat to come out onto their property to do an assessment, to tell them if there's anything that they could do to improve their own property, that's one of our biggest barriers, actually, is finding property owners that own property where there is important habitat for the fish to be willing to work on a voluntary basis to allow us to work with them to restore habitat. So that's another way that people can help. And then even if you don't live on a stream or on a shoreline, if you do things to manage the stormwater that's running off of your property in a more appropriate way, that can make a difference as well. Because as you know, toxics from stormwater is another issue for both fish as well as for the orcas. So doing things like building a rain garden or getting rainwater harvesting cisterns installed on your property or both, those are things that you can do personally on your own property. Converting your lawn to native plants, planting more trees, all of those kinds of things. If everybody was doing that together as a community, that would make a huge difference for the fish.
And an opportunity, if you're interested in getting involved with some of our Whale Scout Helping Out events, our next one is on December 2nd at Whitney Bridge Park in Auburn. And I was particularly drawn to this site on the Green River because it has four species of Pacific salmon. And I wanted to ask you sort of, I guess, a more basic question about salmon, but why do we see Chinook, Coho, Chum and pink salmon on the Green River and not on other rivers, where, like, where I live in the Sammamish River, we have sockeye, Chinook, and coho?
Mm-hmm. So each species of salmon, it's interesting to see how they have evolved over time, and each one has a little bit of a different preference for where they like to spawn and where they like to rear as juveniles. And their timing. So where you find the different species of salmon is really dependent on what kinds of habitats are available in each river or stream system. Like at a very basic level, one of the things is sockeye is a species of salmon that needs a large lake as part of its life cycle. And so those rivers that don't have a large lake in their watershed tend not to have sockeye as a run of salmon. Now, in your specific example, it gets a little bit more complicated because the history of the Sammamish River in as part of the Cedar-Sammamish watershed is pretty complex in terms of how we have replumbed the landscape in the last 150 years. So the Sammamish River was a very different kind of habitat, and the way it was connected to Puget Sound was very different historically, right? Because the Ballard Locks did not exist. So fish did not get to the Sammamish River by passing through the Ballard Locks if you had been here 200 years ago. And so that's probably one of the reasons why there isn't a pink population in the Sammamish River, is because historically there may not have been a pink run in the way that the system was historically. The outlet for the system historically was at the south end of Lake Washington, and it was not a big open river. The southern outlet was the river called the Black River, which ran out of the south end of Lake Washington and then into the Green Duwamish River. But it was like there was a whole series of wetlands at the south end of Lake Washington without a really clear channel. So the anadromous salmon populations in the whole Cedar-Sammamish system historically were a lot lower than they are now. And some of the ones that we see now are the result of hatchery introductions as well over time. So it gets really, really complicated.
Yeah. It's just amazing how much we've changed things and how well salmon have adapted, you know, despite everything that we've done.
Well, that's what's the amazing thing about salmon and why they are still here in this landscape. If you think about even back to the ice ages, I mean, one of the things that makes salmon resilient is that they are able to adapt to changes in the system. And, you know, as the glaciers retreated, you know, we always learn about how salmon always go back to the place they were born. And that's true for the most part, but they do have a certain percentage of salmon who stray, and they go and they try out other streams in the area or nearby. And that's how they repopulate and recolonized streams and rivers as the glaciers retreated. And so they can actually deal with a lot of change. And because they have all these different strategies for how they live their lives and where they like to spawn and rear, different populations will do better depending on how you change things. But it's also an example, understanding that about the salmon is also an example of how significantly we have impacted their habitat that they are actually now struggling to remain viable. That we have so significantly changed the habitat, we haven't given them opportunities to express that resiliency that they have, and they're having a tough time making it now. And so it's depressing, but it also gives me hope that they are such a resilient species that if we just make the decision to actually do the things that we know that we can do to restore their habitat and make spaces for them to live again and to survive and to thrive, we can turn this around. We could recover salmon, but we have to choose as a society that that's important enough to us that we're willing to take the actions necessary to do that. And a big part of that is restoring the habitat. And that's difficult for some people because they don't want to change how they're living on the landscape. And until we decide that we are willing to make those changes, then we're not going to be successful in recovering the fish.
That's a very good point. And I think more and more people are starting to understand it. And, you know, I always tell whale people, if we're going to, you know, want to see whales in Puget Sound. Shouldn't we start making some better choices? And wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a recovered, you know, Chinook salmon population in Puget Sound and we were able to see more forays into Puget Sound by these killer whales? And if everyone has more fish, we're all more happy, right?
right. And, yeah, and sorry. We know there's lots of things that we can do. We know what there is to do. It's a matter of deciding that we're willing to do it as a community and then deciding that it's worth it to us to dedicate the level of resources that are necessary in order to make those changes.
One big change that may be just around the corner in our area has to do with farmed salmon. And I wanted to get your opinion and your update on what's happening right now with farmed Atlantic salmon in Puget Sound.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's been big in the news since the big spill of Atlantic salmon that happened back in August. So we've had, for a while now, we've had a series of net pens in Puget Sound that have been managed by a private company to raise Atlantic salmon, which are not native to this area, in those pens and to sell them as food. And this is a practice that's common in, like in Norway, in Europe, there's a lot of net pen farms. There's a number of them in British Columbia. But in the United States, on the West Coast, we are the only state that has allowed these net pens to be built and used for Atlantic salmon. And they're still investigating all the causes of what happened with the spill, but it looks like there was some serious problems with maintenance of this pen. And so there were a number of fish that escaped, and they were found all up and down the coast. They went pretty far. And that is of great concern to people. There were people who were already organizing before this happened to ask questions about whether this was a good idea to allow this kind of activity in Puget Sound when there were so many people who were working so hard to save native species and the health of Puget Sound and whether this kind of activity was consistent with that. But this spill has really elevated people's awareness of these net pens and their concern about the potential impact. And in fact, just yesterday, there was a hearing down at the Capitol in Olympia. One of the committees, I think it was the Senate Natural Resources Committee, and one of the topics was about this spill. And there is discussion now that there may be a bill put forward in the next legislative session that starts in January to no longer allow the farming of Atlantic salmon in net pens in Puget Sound.
And
to phase them out.
Can you describe what the threat is to wild salmon populations?
Yeah, so there's a couple. So one concern is that they have the potential to compete with our wild salmon to go into the rivers and spawn. They've been looking to see if they're finding any examples of that. Unfortunately, so far, they have not. But that doesn't mean that in the future they won't become successful and start establishing themselves and become a competitive invasive species. Another concern is just even within the net pens, even if they don't escape, the concentration of so many fish in one place, the pollution that causes from all of their waste, and also their increased potential to have diseases or to spread diseases. There have been some concerns raised in British Columbia that the net pens up there have contributed to a sea lice that then has been affecting the health of the native salmon populations. So there's things like that as well that that some folks who are concerned about these Atlantic salmon are concerned about.
So I read that a group called the Wild Fish Conservancy has sued Cook Aquaculture, who owns these net pens, under the Clean Water Act. And I believe what I read is that they're going to, for each fish that escaped, that is its own individual violation, which comes with like a $52,000 fine. I mean, do you think this is going to hold up in court? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, it's an excellent question. I think they do have a case. I think the question is, will it make it through the system and actually have a conclusion, or if they will settle out of court before there is an actual legal decision. When you count up the number of fish that escaped times 50,000 per fish, it becomes a very large number.
Yes.
And I heard that the analysis is that it's likely not going to be the top end. It probably won't be the bottom end either. And so probably the discussion is going to be where within that fairly large range will the number land. But I think it's putting a lot of pressure on Cook Aquaculture to realize that there are folks who are very concerned about the impact of their net pens in Puget Sound.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I look forward to seeing where it leads and where it takes off to and what decisions may be made. Is there anything else you would like to share with our audience before we wrap up today?
Yeah, you know, one of the other things that's been in the news, it was a couple weeks ago, that I think is important for folks to be aware of, is there was the Puget Sound Partnership, which is the state agency that works with all of the partners across Puget Sound to decide on what are the most important actions to recover Puget Sound, and how, and does an evaluation with all the scientists of how we're doing. They just released their most recent report called the State of the Sound Report, where they're looking at all the different indicators that are indicating the health of Puget Sound. And their conclusions are pretty similar to what we've been talking about right now, that they're very concerned about the decline of the orca population and the related concern about the status of recovery of salmon and how critical the recovery of salmon is, not just to the salmon and for all the other reasons we care about salmon, but for the success of the orcas as well. And there's some conclusions that they talk about in there that I think are important for people to pay attention to, especially the one I would call out is the amount of resources that are currently available to do habitat restoration work, and I'm talking about funding, really, is so low compared to what the identified need is. And that is one of our biggest challenges, and that's sort of going back to what we talked about at the beginning. We as a community need to decide how much we value our orcas and our salmon. And if we are willing to make the investment that's really necessary to turn things around, because right now the kind of funding that's being allocated to do this work is a very small percentage of what's actually needed. And so I think that's important for people to be aware of and to be thinking about that as you're thinking about how to advocate for these fish. We're not going to get there if we keep thinking that doing habitat restoration is a small side project. We have to transform how we think about it. It's more like, so we have our gray infrastructure, we have our transportation system, and the amount of money that we invest in our roads in order to keep them working for people. And then you look at the amount of money that we invest in our natural resources and in salmon recovery, and the difference is astronomic. So we have, as a society, have a value that we're willing to spend a couple hundred million dollars on a bridge over a river on I-5. But if you ask for that amount of money for all the projects that we would like to do for salmon recovery across the state of Washington, people look at you in disbelief. So how do we change that conversation where it doesn't sound outrageous to ask for that same level of investment for our ecosystem as we do for our built environment?
Well, it's very interesting food for thought. I mean, is there anything that people like me can do?
Well, certainly you can be keeping track of what's being made, what decisions are being made by our elected officials when it comes to funding decisions, because ultimately they're the ones that decide how much money is allocated to the different needs of our community. And so things like the grant funds that come from the state, as well as the federal government, that are allocated to projects that restore habitat for salmon. You know, right now we don't have a capital budget. It wasn't passed by our legislature this year, and that's impacting lots of people for lots of different reasons, but it's also impacting the fish because there's a huge amount of projects that were supposed to go forward that are not. But even if that capital budget did pass, the list of projects that was put together for Puget Sound for salmon recovery, there's a huge list of projects that are ready to go. They just need money that would make a significant difference across the region that were not included in they fell below the funding line because it was decided that there was not enough funding to fund all of those projects. So there's projects ready to go. People have been working for 5, 10, 20 years putting these projects together. All they need is the funding now to get them done, and they're not proposed for funding. So, and I think very few people are aware of this, and nobody's asking their elected officials about these projects and if we could find a way to fund them. And until that changes, we're going to keep getting a couple $100 million for a road project and, you know, $1 million for a salmon project.
That is so frustrating. Wow.
Very.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think people value the built environment, like you said, and not see the value in what's native and natural. You know, just in my neck of the woods, we're working with the Wayne Golf Course and, you know, trying to decide what a golf course should look like and if that's a park. And, you know, I'm even having a hard time having my voice be heard saying that, you know, the way to attract people and to elevate the status of this place is to let it be natural, is to, you know, put trees back in the ground and instead of putting a sports field or something different that would be built or constructed, that really the value is in it being wild. So yeah, it really is a battle that all of us can take up in a small way where we all live.
That's a great example. It's a perfect example because what the Bothell community chooses to do with that opportunity will make a huge difference. There's a huge opportunity to restore habitat for the fish there. And, it's possible to make that choice and to be a major contribution to the recovery of salmon populations. But it's up to that community to decide that that's the highest and best use for that particular property.
Yeah, and convincing the city that it's a value, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're fortunate that you do have a mayor right now in Bothell who's very supportive of that kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure he could use additional support.
Yeah.
Because it's not like the mayor makes the decision by himself.
Right. So, well, anyway, I want to thank you so much for coming on our podcast. And I'm excited to announce that we will be hearing more from you in the future as you give us a status update of what's going on with Puget Sound salmon. And I want to invite, if people have questions that they want to submit, they can send them to email me at info@whalescout.org, and maybe in a future podcast you could answer some of those questions.
I'd be happy to do that. That'd be great. Thanks so much for inviting me, Whitney. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and share with your listeners about salmon.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, on our website with the show link, will include other links to Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group, where you can learn more about the work that Jeanette Dorner is doing. And we will connect more in the future. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been fun.
Thank you all so much for listening. And again, if you have questions or show topic ideas that you would like to have me discuss with Jeanette Dorner, please send those along and email them to info@whalescout.org. And to have these podcasts sent directly to your phone, subscribe on iTunes. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. J'esquive conseils, préjugés, défilés, dégueulés, télé.